You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 100.5 FM.
For almost 3 years, 300 homeless people in Vancouver have had guaranteed housing and a barrage of support through a federal research project. The project is titled At Home, Chez Soi, and it's taking place in five Canadian cities. The money for that project will run out in 6 months, and there has been no sign from the federal government that there will be an extension. Psychologist Julian Summers is lead investigator on the Vancouver team, and he's joined me this morning in the studio. Hello, Julian.
Good morning.
Now, what characteristics would a typical participant in the study have?
Well, some of the characteristics are defined by the protocol for the study, that is who we were aiming to try and make contact with. So those characteristics that were defined at the beginning were that individuals needed to be in some significant way homeless and chronically homeless. The second sort of overarching characteristic that we were trying to identify in participants is experience with mental illness. So those were really the main defining characteristics at the outset: chronic homelessness, mental illness. And then when we went about actually identifying people who've met those criteria, we found that several other things sort of came along. So the vast majority of people that met our criteria in Vancouver were male. So about three quarters were male. About two-thirds of the participants had current, fairly serious substance use problems, and nearly one-third of them were daily drug users of one type or another, and I can say more about that later. A significant number had children, but not with them, so children under the age of 18. And you know, age-wise, they were about 40 years on average, years of age, and had been homeless. More than half of them had been homeless for 3 years in their lives so far.
Now, the project is based on a housing first approach. What is housing first?
Well, I think it's fair to say now that you're going to get a variety of answers to that question depending on who you ask. But there is a definition that exists at least in academic writing that has its origins in a program that was developed and really well defined in New York City. And so this is now kind of an exemplar of Housing First, and the program is called Pathways to Housing. So following that, and that's really the exemplar that we've used in our study. So there could be, you know, different sort of flavors of vanilla. This is our flavor, right, is the Pathways model. So following from that, there are, I guess, a few practices that are defining. One is a commitment to rapid rehousing. So the focus of the program is on people who have been hard to house, who have really fallen through the cracks of existing systems, and who have mental illness. And in order to accomplish rapid rehousing, a few things need to be in place. One is that there need to be a few housing options available at any given time, so that when an individual is approached, wherever they are, at a shelter, on the street, the part of the opening opportunity extended to them is there are two, three apartments available now, like today. Might you like to go and look at one of these to start, and we can go to the others as well. So it rapid in the sense that it's actually possible from the point of contact with the participant or the individual, pardon me, to reasonably expect that they could actually be housed that day. That's one characteristic. Related to that, because we're not talking about homelessness in general, we're talking about people who have certain experiences of homelessness and people who have certain health-related needs, including mental illness needs, is the capacity to support them. so that they're so that not meeting their health needs or not responding to their mental health needs isn't, in essence, setting them up for failure in their new accommodations. Now, on the one hand, there needs to be the capacity to respond to those needs, but another characteristic of this program is choice in the individual's hands in terms of how they would go about accessing those services, when, and to what degree. So there's very little that is expected or required of the individual other than staying in contact with some representative of a team.
So rather than doing a gradual entry where first of all you get off drugs or you go into some kind of shelter before you have your own house, it's kind of opposed to that. It's like, let's get you in a house and then go from there.
It is. There is a contrast between those two styles. Yeah, and you know, I have to say that there's some disagreement really in the sort of the housing community and in the related academic community about, you know, whether one can make blanket statements concerning which of those approaches might be better, whether there in fact might be sort of different strokes for different folks, and some people may, you know, so there are some unresolved questions there. But you're right to identify that this approach is really asserting a kind of it's taking a value based position that individuals themselves should have greater control over their own recovery and their own futures than many programs historically would have granted them.
Now let's look at the study. There are 500 people enrolled in the study in Vancouver, and they have been divided into three groups, a control group and two other groups. Tell me about those groups.
Well, I'm going to be a bit of a stickler at the outset and actually just clarify that there are two studies in Vancouver that together comprise those 500 individuals. So one study, they all involve homeless people. They all involve people who've been very so-called hard to house. But one study tried to identify people who have relatively less complex problems. Mental health issues, yes, but relatively less complex problems. And for those individuals, we identified 200, and by a process of random assignment, directed people to either usual care, so what's currently available in the city, or to a housing first approach that where the housing, this rapid rehousing approach that I described, is supported by caseworkers. So to the extent that individuals then require health, social, other types of assistance in order to remain stably housed, a caseworker essentially is there to broker access to services and supports in the community. So that's 200 people. We also recruited 300 people whose needs are likely much greater than could reasonably supported by a caseworker. And for those individuals, we, again, by a process of random assignment, directed people to one of three groups. One, again, is usual care in the city of Vancouver. But then we had two intervention conditions. In one condition, the same rapid rehousing scattered throughout the city of Vancouver. And in order to support people, a service model known as assertive community treatment is provided. And this is a team of individuals from a variety of professions and disciplines that are available 24/7 to provide support to people. Again, to help ensure their recovery and their ongoing housing stability. The other intervention is really the same type of supports that I just described, the multi-professional, multidisciplinary supports. But in this case, that team is on site in a building rather than dispersing individuals throughout market housing in the city. 100 people in the study are housed together in one building where those supports are on site. And so over time, we'll learn more. We're beginning to get some insights, but over time, we'll learn more about what difference the nature of the accommodation might make.
So your research goals would be what kind of intervention, what kind of housing, what difference does all that, those various factors make?
Exactly. And at the same time, and for the first time in Vancouver, learn what differences are made through the services and supports that are available.
Now, I know you haven't completed the research yet, but you have put out a couple of early findings reports. What stories have you heard from some of the participants?
I'll start with maybe some general findings and see if I can illustrate them with individual stories. In general, in the city of Vancouver, we're finding that indeed it's for starters, it's possible to mount these new services and supports, which previously didn't exist in the ways that I described in Vancouver. Second, it's possible to actually, I should say, it's no problem identifying people who meet the criteria for need. But more importantly, perhaps, it's possible to find success through the services that we've mounted. And success, of course, you know, is defined a lot of different ways. One of the most obvious ones is housing stability. So people leave their wherever they were. Most of the participants actually were recruited from in and around where we are right now in the neighborhood of the downtown east side. And wherever they move to, the housing stability in the first year is about 3.5 times the housing stability in the usual care group. So they move, and by several different measures, they become stable residents in new communities. They report themselves integrating into those communities, knowing their neighborhoods and feeling a sense of belonging. Improvements in their overall quality of life. So a number of meaningful changes at the individual level and neighborhood level. We're also seeing in Vancouver some changes that actually kind of ripple out to the broader community. So, for example, people in the 300 that I mentioned with relatively more complex needs were visiting the emergency department at St. Paul's Hospital on average about 3 times per year before entering the study. That number goes down significantly compared to the comparison in usual care after randomization. So this is, of course, indirectly an indicator of, in all likelihood, their improved health. But it also is good news for the emergency department, and which, of course, the people there, the staff, experience tremendous frustration with what they see as kind of a revolving door. And in a small way, I mean, this is not a very large population that we're dealing with in our study, but in a small way is contributing to, you know, less congestion at the emergency department. Another overall finding at this point that extends out to the community is the impact on crime. And there's a kind of a complicated or a complex literature talking about the association between homelessness and offending and crimes that are really in some meaningful way caused by being homeless. But regardless of how one sort of links the sort of the causal arrows between homelessness and offending, there is a strong association. And after entering housing in this study, again, compared to usual care, the participants in the At Home Project are seeing their involvement with crime reduced by 2/3 or more in the 1 year after commencing housing. So this, again, is something that if you think about sort of the implications, especially of property crime, where there obviously are victims, people whose belongings are now taken away, damage to stores and businesses, the ripple through to insurance. This is actually a finding of significance to the people themselves, but to the broader community.
Now, there were a couple of stories in the early findings report that I read. There's somebody called Jay who stopped drinking and signed up for carpentry school, and then there was somebody DB, who said she used to cry every day and hated life in the shelter and had no privacy, and now in her own place. So there were some very, very moving stories in the early findings report. Now, the federal government allocated $110 million for the project in 2008, mm-hmm. and your original end date was March next year, which is 6 months from now. Had you expected to get an extension on the funding?
We'd hoped, of course. I'm not sure I could say expected. Maybe at the time the study began, that was actually, as you've pointed out, a few years ago and long enough ago that the economic outlook itself was different than it is today. Like everyone involved with the project, so this is, many, many organizations, service providers, the Business Improvement Association, philanthropic groups, a huge diversity of agencies. We've all, of course, hoped that this would seed long-term change. Now, my own view, though, looking at the study from the standpoint of research, is really that it's probably not, it's not scientifically sensible, actually, to go into a study thinking that, or hoping rather, that at the end there would be the ongoing provision of the same services that you're providing at the beginning. And the reason is that we're doing the research in order to find out whether, you, for all we knew at the beginning, usual care could work very well. In which case, a major finding would be that continuing to invest in what's currently provided is the indicated course, and we really don't need to significantly complicate the landscape of services and supports. Of course, that's not what we've learned, but it's that slightly different approach. So where we are now is actually, in my case and in the case of the research team, our view on the implications of the results is actually not that there should be ongoing support for the 300 people receiving housing. Our view is that we should get our heads around the number of individuals whose needs match those of the participants that we recruited, and scaling up the intervention well beyond the 300 that are currently receiving services and supports, but in order to extend the opportunity for similar benefits to that larger population in need.
It sounds like from the things that you told me about the emergency services and other things that have come out of this study, that there would not be a net cost to government of scaling things up.
It's that appears to be the case, actually. And you referenced the early findings report that is based on experiences across all five of the sites involved in this trial. The argument can be made that, especially for individuals who are relatively high service users, that the cost of delivering this model of service is more than offset by reductions in costs that would otherwise be incurred through the use of emergency services in particular. So there is already evidence that for a subset of participants, the economic argument is favorable. I think that's important. I think there are people clearly that are quite focused on financial implications of this type of thing. But in most of healthcare, if that's what we compare this to, it's actually quite difficult to find evidence of cost savings through the delivery of healthcare. In most cases, and to just try and put it in plain language, it's simply cheaper to let people die. So really, the standard, in my opinion, of demonstrating financial savings in order to justify in some important way a program like this is, I think, a little bit cold-hearted, because it holds interventions for a systematically disenfranchised group up to a much higher standard than we would hold for, let's say, a new cancer treatment or a new surgical procedure. So one of my thoughts when I hear that question is, why are you asking that?
What are you hearing from participants about the end of the project coming up in as little as 6 months?
It seems to, yeah, it's an interesting, and I've been you know trying to follow that myself just by talking to some of our field interviewers and when I'm around to our participants myself, it seems to be a little bit surprising. We were expecting considerable anxiety, to be honest, and that's true in some cases. There is palpable anxiety, and that's what we would expect. But we're also seeing, in some cases, a little bit less worry than you might expect. And you know, I'm still puzzling that one through a bit. But my sense of it is that for a number of our participants, they have been so systematically disenfranchised, disempowered, that anticipating sort of yet another loss is not at all unfamiliar. And so that could be behind some of the lack of response. But for sure, there are many individuals who are highly anxious. And we've had some reports from service providers, the teams that are going out and meeting with people, that they've begun already, if their name comes up, let's say, on a list for a waiting list for low income housing, and typically in the downtown east side, they're leaving the accommodations in order to take advantage of that and ensure that they actually have a place that would endure after April of next year.
Thank you so much for coming down and talking to me this morning, Julian.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Julian Summers. He's lead investigator in Vancouver for the At Home Chez Soi project. This project is looking at the costs and benefits of a housing-first approach to homelessness among those with mental health issues.